G'day, I am Mordechai Becher.
And I am Yehoshua Kirsch.
And welcome to the Two Rabbis in the Podcast. And we are very happy that you are watching, listening, etc. And if you like this, then press a like or something, and share, tell your friends about it, etc. Let's get the word out. This week, we are talking about animals. Jewish attitude to animals from the perspective philosophical, maybe halachic. We'll discuss a number of aspects of Jewish attitude to the animal world. Does that sound correct?
As yes,
what we plan on
yes
doing?
It does. That's okay. What we plan on doing.
Good. So I want to begin with just a Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a little known, it's a book. It's really less than a book. It's more like,
is it a cookbook?
It's a vegetarian. Yeah. It's like a long essay. And it's called Talalei Orot. And it is about Tamei HaMitzvos, reasons for mitzvah. I was just looking at it this past week. And because I'm teaching a course on Tamei HaMitzvos next semester at YU. So I want to use this book. But one of the things he points out is that our attitude to animals, he says just something interesting. I just want to read to you what he says. He says there is a concealed rebuke in the Torah's permission for us to eat meat. He says, because the Torah writes, ki toimar ochla basar, ki ta'ave nafshecha lechol basar. It was the introduction, the preamble to the mitzvah of how to slaughter an animal correctly, is this. When you say, I want to eat meat because your soul desires to eat meat, then this is how you should do it. He says, it's type of interesting. The Torah doesn't give that type of preamble before anything else. When you desire whatever, you desire vegetables, you should take tithes. It doesn't say that. When you desire intimacy, you should do this. It doesn't. It says when you desire, he says it's almost like a subtle rebuke.
Nice.
That just keep in mind, this is something which I'm allowing because you feel that you have to have it.
Nice.
And he says, indeed, after the sin of Adam and Eve, one of the things he says is, he says that the, I'll just read you the Hebrew. He says, Hine, lo tuchal la'atzor ba'ad netiyatcha, ki imal yedei kvisha musarit. It's like Hashem is saying, I'm not able to stop you from your desire. I'm not willing to stop you from your desire. However, I will place kvisha musarit, some level of ethical containment on it. V'zot hakvisha od lo bat ata, but you haven't yet ethical conquest of it, but we haven't got there yet. We haven't conquered that. He says, however, why od hi nidreshet lecha, because you still need bishvil chugim yoter krovim elecha. He says human compassion, human love, human sensitivity, if it's going to be distributed evenly to all species, will not be effective. So what Hashem does is, he says, I'm going to only expect it of you to the maximum of your own species. Hopefully there'll be a trickle-down effect, but the maximum requirement of love, sensitivity, and so on is to fellow humans, with the hope that eventually messianic times, as it was in the Garden of Eden, the human being's feelings of sensitivity and love will be for anything living. Is that
in the introduction to Shari Yosher, sort of Shimon Shkop, when he is talking about the mitzvah of Kadoshim Tiyu, and that we should be singularly devoted to the well-being of others, like Hashem is singularly devoted to us. And he sets up a kind of, it's like a hierarchy. You know, we start with those in our inner circle, and then we expand it and we expand it. But the last part is that it should expand to kol habria, to every aspect of creation, that love.
Right. Absolutely. And he says, just realistically speaking, after the sin of Adam and Eve, realistically speaking, for the human, it will be spread too thin. That's how Rav Kook's putting it. We spread too thin. So we're allowed to eat meat because we need to, but we should do it with reminders and sensitivity. So the example he gives is, let's say you're supposed to cover the blood of certain animals when you shech them. Which animals? Chaya, wild animals, and birds. He says, what's in common? He says, these are animals that don't depend on the human being for their livelihood. He says, the domesticated animals, you're feeding them, you're caring for them, you're getting water for them, you're protecting them from predators. To some degree, there's a quid pro, right? I don't have to feel so guilty. But he says, I'm taking an animal which doesn't depend on the human being, which lives independent of the human being, birds, right, wild animals. He says, there, covering the blood is a way of saying, this is not ideal.
Now, in the beginning, chapter 1 of the Torah, so when it talks about when we are given a mandate / bracha, we're told pruervu umilu es haaretz v'kivshuha, and then we're told,
yeah.
Right, but then we're told uredu, and then we should manage, and we talk about degas hayam, the of shemayim, and the animals. So it does, it sounds from over there that we are going to have some kind of managerial relationship, even sure, with fish and birds and things 100%. Like that, not just animals.
He's not disagreeing with that, obviously, right? Yeah. That means we have dominion over them, right? Because we are superior.
But for some purpose, you would assume. Exactly. You would assume for some purpose.
Yeah, sure.
Not it just could, to be in charge, but...
I mean, it could be for food. Or it could be for productivity.
In the beginning, it wouldn't have been for food, though, right?
Correct, right.
So it would have had to be most likely for productivity.
Maybe, right. And to preserve species and so on and so forth, which we see that the Torah has an interest in that. You know, the Sefer Achinuch says when it comes to the prohibition of taking the bird and the mother, the eggs and the mother, you can't take them both. So his idea is because you're destroying the producer and the product simultaneously. So you're type of like erasing that line. He says, you know, you don't, if you take the mother, the eggs can hatch. If you take the eggs, the mother can have more. If you take both, that's it. It's over. Hashem is interested in the preservation of all species. Right? There is something to that. And the human being, you know, can take a role in that. You know, so one of the ideas of Cook's concept is found in other places as well, where, just for example, I sent you that the Shulchan Aruch. You know, there's a, when someone buys new clothing. So those of you who are familiar with Hebrew, someone buys new clothing. What do you say to them? Titchadesh, which literally means get a new one. Well, I just got a new one. It's like, mate, right? That blessing makes no sense. In Hebrew, everyone says, ah, titchadesh, get a new one. It's like, todawa, I just got a new. So actually, if you look in the Code of Jewish Law, Shulchan Aruch says, the original blessing, which has been shortened, is tevaleh betitchadesh, meaning may you merit wearing this out and get a new one. In other words, I want you to wear this suit till you have to get a new one, right? And then get a new one. So it's a nice blessing. So the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, in the Code of Jewish Law says, custom is not to say that when the person has leather or fur. In other words, yes, I'm allowed to use the leather, but to actually come up with a celebratory blessing and say...
This is not talking about Shechianu.
No.
This is talking about that other, bracha of Titchadesh.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, cool.
This is in the Shulchan Aruch, Orach Chaim 2:23, says this, Haminhag lomar, the custom is to say, Lemishaloved beged chadash, to someone who is wearing new clothing, tevaleh betit chadash, wear it out and get a new one. There are some who write, she'ein loimar ken al minalim obgadim hanasim orashel bohem. Some say you should not say this about for shoes or any clothing made of animal skins.
I know you're going to read more of this, but I just want to clarify, because I oftentimes you will hear people, I guess they're mixing it up with Shehecheyanu, that if you get a new item that's made out of leather, have you heard of that? That there are people who suggest that you shouldn't say Shehecheyanu on such a...
No. Well, in that paragraph, he starts off, he's talking about the laws of Shehecheyanu, special blessing we make on new things, etc. So he says, on something which is not so important, kagon chaluk or minalim, vampalas, like a chaluk, I mean, like a shirt, or minalim, or shoes, or socks, you don't make the bracha.
But that's not because it's leather. That's because it's not important.
Right. It's not so important. And then after that, he says it's customary to bless people and say tevaleh betit chadash. But he says we don't say that. Some say it's not. We don't say it on leather or shoes or things made of animal skins. Why de'im kain? Because if so, if he wears it out and gets a new one, hey, it's rishon lahamit behema acheret tchila. You have to kill another animal. She chadash mimena beged acheret, to make a new clothing. Uktiv, and it says, Varachamav al kol masav, God's mercy is on all his creatures. Vehine, the Rama says, Hatam chalushmo, this is a very weak reasoning. Veina nira, right, and it doesn't seem to be so compelling. Mikol makom, nevertheless. Rabim makpidim al zesh shalola omra, many, many are careful not to say this. And actually, if you look, there's a famous responsum of Rabbi Chezkel Landau, the Noda Yehuda, where a Jew asked him, you know, in Europe, apparently his time, early modern period, hunting was under the domain of the government. So you have to have, I guess it's also like that in some places.
Permits. You'd have to get a permit or something.
Right. Yeah. So if you owned an estate, you could go hunting on it. It's your estate.
Right.
So it was like a matter of some prestige. You would invite someone to go hunting. So here's a Jew who's a wealthy businessman. He's got an estate. He wants to invite some non-Jewish, you know, business people. I think they're non-Jews, but he wants to invite people to hunt with him. And the Noda Yehuda says, I'm a little shocked by this activity. He said the only hunters we find in the Torah are like Esav, Nimrod. They were not good people. He said, this is not the way of the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he quotes this Ramah not to say tevaleh betit chadash because of compassion. He doesn't quote the part where the Ramah says it's not compelling. He says, you see from here that he says, if we don't even bless someone with getting a new garment because you'd have to kill another animal, how could you be engaged in recreational activity that involves killing animals for recreation? He says, how can an Israelite kill living beings just to pass his time? He says, I think this matter contributes to cruelty. And if your livelihood depends on it, you know, sababa, go ahead. But otherwise, he says, I don't see it as appropriate.
I met my wife and I are friendly with this couple from Arkansas, Elm Springs, Arkansas, named Douthit. Their name is Douthit. And I think we traveled there twice and spent some time with them. And at one point on one of those trips, they took us aside to tell us about how important hunting is culturally to them. They're like Scotch-Irish. And Harold, who's the husband, mentioned that, but now he's in his 80s probably, but he said when he was young, his family was poor. They had like a dirt floor in their house. And hunting was how they ate, you know, it's how they had meat. But he said that it continued even when that was no longer necessary, absolutely necessary for them. Hunting continued to be an important part of their life. Like he remembers as a young child going with his father and his uncles and et cetera. And he continued to do that with his children. And there was a kind of cultural experience. It wasn't like that image you have of people on a train, you know, riding through Nebraska, shooting buffalo from the, you know, the windows and just for sport killing. These were, in other words, there are cultures for whom it's sacred and it's deep and there are other aspects to it.
I assume they eat the animal. I assume yes, they utilize yes. the skin. Yes. I assume they even maybe utilize the bones or the hooves.
Yes.
There's some too. But what the Nodi Bihuda is saying is to do it recreationally.
Yeah.
It's just leaving aside the fact that you put yourself in danger, because there is some danger if you go hunting with Dick Cheney. So, but otherwise, he says, leaving aside the danger, he says it's a cultivation to some degree to do it for recreational purposes, cultivating cruelty.
But why, in other words, that cruelty, would that be different if somebody was a shoychet? In other words, if the killing of animals is somehow breeds cruelty.
Well, so, recreationally.
But so that's how it works. That the
it seems to be.
In other words, your
legitimate reason.
Your motive will change the impact on your person.
I think so. I think
okay.
so.
Okay.
It certainly sounds like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We know that there is a prohibition, which the Gemara says is min ha-Torah, of tsar ba'alei chayim, to alleviate pain to animals, taking the burden off the donkey. There's a great source, the Rambam in Guide for the Perplexed. Maimonides points out, he says, you know, Bilam is going to curse the Jewish people. He's a prophet. He's misusing prophecy. He is ignoring God's command. He is going to curse the blessed people. He's like a nasty guy. Right, he's on his way. He's stopped in the path by an angel. Famous story. The donkey talks. He hits the donkey, but first he hits the donkey three times. So the Rambam points out, you know what? He's doing all of this. The first thing the angel tells him is,
"What are you hitting him for?
Why are you hitting your donkey?" It's like unbelievable. It's like a guy's committed armed robbery. He shot people in the bank. The police surround his car. Come out with your hands up. He comes out. The police saying, "You know, your tail light's out." That's it, right? So he says that, you see how important that is. Fascinating. And we know that even though we eat meat, and this is actually a good point that you're making, the distinction of the motivation, we eat meat and we're allowed to, but you know, there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia 85, talks about Rebbe. So Rebbe Yehuda Anasi had some type of stomach disease, which was very painful. And the Gemara says this painful illness was initiated by something he did and stopped when he did something. So what happened? He was sitting there, and apparently there's a line of animals being taken to slaughter. And a calf comes out and nuzzles up to him. He pushes it away and says, "Leave. This is why you were created." Bam, incredible divine providence, he starts getting stomach pains. When did they leave him? So they left him when his maid was standing there with a broom, and she was about to whack a weasel or a mole that was on their porch. And he said, "Leave it be. Verachamav al kol masav, God's mercy is upon all his creatures." That's when the pain left him. It's like interesting. So the commentary struggled with, because at the end of the day, he's accurate. I mean, this calf is not going to develop a cure for cancer. This calf is not going to save the world's ecology, right? The calf is a guy. It was created for this. So what did he do wrong? So some say it was the fact that it was young. It was a baby. So, you know, an argument against veal. Some say that it wasn't so much, he was right intellectually, but emotionally the thing snuggled up against you to push it away and say the philosophical, right? You know, you can't just be a machine.
It's a lack of empathy.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like the Ramban, right? The Ramban's explanation, like his disagreement with the Rambam as to why we have some of these mitzvahs, which according to the Rambam, it's because animals have feelings, like let's say Osov Espino, not shechting what ends up being a mother and her calf on the same day, or Shiluah Haken, something where there's an acknowledgement that animals have feelings, mm-hmm. and a mother cow suffers tremendously if it sees its calf being killed, and because of that, the Torah, you know, wants us to step back from it. The Ramban disagrees, and he says it's not to protect the animal per se; it's to teach us
compassion. But at the end of the day, if it was not somehow, if the animal was not suffering as a result of this, it wouldn't teach me compassion.
Well, I could still have empathy for it even up it until when I take its life.
Oh, that's true. Right. I'm saying the Ramban is the disagreement is not from one pole to the other.
Right.
The Ramban agrees that the animal is suffering. It's just the primary.
No, 100%.
The prime directive.
We are the address. Yeah. We're the address. And the fact that it's suffering is agreed upon. It's just that it's not to protect the animal. It's to mentor us on how to become more godly, to have empathy for the animals.
Correct. And you know, so it's type of interesting, but there is this idea. So some say that was the lack of empathy. I remember asking Reb Moshe when I was learning laws of kashrut way back in whatever. And I asked Reb Moshe Shapiro because I'd read about veal. I think it was me who asked.
Yes, I remember this being you who asked.
Confusing
him.
Someone
yes.
else, but yeah. So
when you have an out of body experience and you're looking at yourself, if it's blurry, you can't tell it's you all the time. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I told him they take the calves from almost from birth. They confine them into an area so they cannot move around, so that the muscles become soft. They feed them only certain stuff. They keep them
milk,
out.
Tons of milk.
That's right. And so you get this very, very delicate meat called veal. And Reb Moshe was horrified by my description. And he said, such a thing is prohibited. He says, Tzar Balei Chayim. So how do you, so, you know, there is that sensitivity.
I remember from the time you told me about that, I stopped eating veal. You did clarify, though, that there might be different grades of veal.
Yes.
There's like pink veal. There's more like gray veal.
They call milk fed veal is what this is talking about, and that's prohibited. Yeah. Just the fact that it's a young animal might also be called veal. That he wasn't talking about.
Right.
Yeah. So,
but I stopped eating veal at that time. So the way I did it was I just took it upon myself. I would mention it if somebody asked me about it, but it became a kind of humorous thing at the family table. Anytime we were at somebody's house who served veal, my kids just could not get enough of watching me pass up on the veal. And there'd be discussions with my father and my kids and everybody at the table about it. Just always became a thing. And I just want to, so that was
raised awareness. That was your intention.
Yes. But I always said, this is my own thing. Obviously, this is not halakhically required. I'm doing it based on your conversation with Ramosha. But what years later, I was studying with this couple who planned to get married they already were engaged, let's say a year before the wedding, but they wanted, especially the husband, wanted to learn more about Jewish practice because his wife was, you know, a traditional and he wasn't. So I learned with him during the year and I learned with both of them. I became close to them. I actually was Masader Kedushin at their wedding. After they got married a couple months later, they called me up and invited me to come to their apartment because they said they had something they wanted to share with me. And their introduction was, you shared Torah with us, you know, and now, and it was, you shared things that were very dear to you with us, and we're very grateful. So now we have something that's dear to us that we want to share with you. And then they showed me like a trove of information about chickens and especially eggs, you know, the egg production and how ridiculous it is, you know, like if you see some of these places and the what has to be tremendous suffering that these chickens are going through. They have them several chickens to one cage. There are times when they cut off the beaks of the chicken because they're in the one cage and they don't want them killing each other by pecking each other. And it was just like, so, and they were sharing this with me and I felt like a shagetz because this is, you know, this is something that they have all the evidence for it. And it's supposed to fit this category of perhaps of unnecessary Tzar Bali Chaim. Somebody could argue whether it's necessary or not. It seems unnecessary, especially because there are cage-free and other options for them. So, but I'm thinking to myself, you know what it would mean to not eat any of those eggs? Because it's not just that when you're going out to buy eggs, you only buy like free-range eggs. Eggs from free-range chickens, but there's almost everything has eggs in it.
Every product.
Yeah. Goods, so like, then there's no way that those eggs are all coming from free-range eggs. So what I did from then, and I still do it, is when I'm out buying eggs, I buy cage-free or free-range eggs, but I know, I do not insist that all the other eggs I eat, and I feel like one of these people that eats kosher, you know, only eats kosher inside kosher. The house. Kind of one of those kind of justifications of, you know, I'm trying
a
little bit.
The truth is the fact that this, you're doing some level of that. I think that's what Rav Kook was pointing out. You know, one of the things he points out is there's a prohibition of eating chaylev. So chaylev is a certain type of fat. It's the most fatty part of the animal around the kidneys and the loins. And one of the things he points out, he says, is that, you know, okay, we're allowed to eat meat. But it's not allowed for the lowliest level of lust that chooses the fattiest thing you can find. He says, no. He says, halutsa sapra'i, the wild luxury of eating the blood, eating the fat. He says, it's too much. Torah says, don't have it. Meat and milk. He says, really? See, not only are you going to kill the animal, but you're also going to steal the milk that is owed to the child, to the calf, and you're going to cook them together? I've got to rant here a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? It's a podcast. I think there's a custom to rant.
Yes,
on podcasts.
I believe it is. I believe it is.
Tama, I mean, hug him. Yeah.
Right.
So I think the meat culture in the religious world got out of hand. I think the levels of insensitivity to this whole idea, I think there are people, I don't want to speak about any particular group, but I think there are religious Jews. If I would tell them this idea from Rav Kook, they'd look at me like I'm out of my mind. Look at me like I'm crazy. right? I mean, you go to a store and there's a, I forgot what they're called, the huge Texas, the
tomahawk stick,
like a 250. And people will choose the butcher. This is the most fattiest of the marbling, and it's been aged. And people will bring out these meat boards. I think they're called
charcuterie.
Yeah, and the meat boards, and some of them are just, I'm completely turned off. They have two levels, not just a board. It's like there's a rack where they're hanging, you know, strips of meat from, and you know, maybe require two people to bring it out.
I am just the description. Is causing me close to fainting. Just the description of it. And everything that disgusts you causes my salivatory glands to kick off.
I enjoy the taste of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You've eaten with me. You know how, you know, me and food are like, you know. But I'm saying, you know, the Torah says, just for example, right? What Rav Kook pointed out about ki ta'ave nafshecha, when you desire. The Gemara in Chulin says this. The Torah says, taught you derech eretz. Limda Torah derech eretz. The Torah wanted to teach you appropriate behavior. Lo yechal adam basa ele bahazman azos. You should only eat meat l'ta'avon, when you really feel you need it, want it. Right. In other words, there's an idea put it in check, keep it in check.
When you're hungry.
Yeah. The Gemara in Pesachim says that am ha'oretz, an ignoramus, is not allowed to eat meat. That's type of interesting. Anyone who doesn't engage in Torah, because some of the commentaries point out, my superiority over the animal is the fact that I have this spiritual elevation, connection to God. I can, etc. So if I'm using that energy for the sake of spiritual elevation, I'm on a higher level. I have that right. I'm higher on the spiritual food chain. If I'm not doing anything spiritually elevating, guy is he's just content with where he is not growing, nothing, then what gives him the right over the animal? What makes him better? He's not exercising his free will. He's not exercising his capacity to grow. It's like inappropriate. I mean, granted, the Tanya says that a person, if a God-fearing individual eats meat, fat meat, and drinks wine, good wine, and he's doing it to expand his mind so that he can feel, I guess, a certain level of comfort so that he can engage in the Torah, fulfill the mitzvah of enjoying of Shabbat, and so on, he says such a thing, it's almost like he's made this meat into a korban, into an offering. On the other hand, going to a shmorg and,
do you remember when we, in Israel, they had those all-you-can-eat breakfasts, like at the Plaza Hotel?
Oh, my gosh.
Or those brunches on Shabbos, those buffet brunches on Shabbos at the hotels.
Now called the Leonardo Plaza.
Yeah, but in our day, it was a lot of money, but it was still like one of those dream situations. And people had strategies, and, you know, like, what do you focus on and what do you not focus on? You can't fill yourself up with bread or salad. You have to go for the meat and the rarest form of meat as much as possible for it.
Ah. Do you not think that that there's something wrong with our...
Yes, yes.
Right? It is, yes. Right? I mean, I have a good friend, Rabbi Menachem Zutnik. There's a large shul here in Passaic. As he feels that one of the greatest problems in the religious world is our obsession with physicality, with luxuries, with materialism. I think one of the manifestations of that is the meat phenomenon, right? And I'll tell you, I'm not innocent of this, right? I do enjoy.
Es chatoi ani mazkir hayom.
Yeah, I don't need to remember them that much because right. It's like very deleting it. But yeah, but I think on a cultural level, it's gone a little too far. It's going a little too far.
The thing is, what some people argue is that within the Frum world, there are so few ways to have fun.
Really? Is that true?
I think there's a lot of ways that the rest of society, let's say you want to go to a movie. There are many communities within the Frum community that would not allow for going to a movie. Let's say you want to go to a sports thing.
Sports game.
It's all my kids, the principal of my children's school when they were young called me to rebuke me because I took them out of school on a Sunday to go to a football game. And he did it in two parts. He said, first of all, you shouldn't take them out of school. And second of all, for a football game? So I said back to him, I said, you have every right to rebuke me for taking them out of school, but I'll be in charge of how they get entertained. But there's like within the Frum community, more in the direction of what we would call yeshivish, but within the Frum community in general, the serious Frum community, there are a lot of things which might technically be permitted, but culturally are frowned upon.
You're saying it's an outlet. It's an outlet.
Right. So you have to sort of be careful if you have a culture that has so little opportunity for enjoyment, to take it away.
I'm not advocating taking it away, but
right.
Put the brakes on a little bit.
I mean, and for people
to have
like
an awareness.
Us,
and people
we should have
awareness that it's an animal. Some say that's one of the reasons behind the prohibition against milk and meat. It's just to create an awareness. Hey, just remember, you know where this comes from. This comes from a dead animal. This is the food,
the life force
that is given to the animal from that dead, just have an awareness, which I think is lacking a little bit.
Yeah, to me, the meat grows on a supermarket shelf.
Yeah, right.
Its entire life is saran wrap.
Well, I got to say, I'm very excited about the possibility. Right now, it's way too expensive. But if it ever becomes a possibility to mass produce factory lab-grown meat, I think that will be wonderful. I think it'd be wonderful for the environment. I'm a little bit of a tree hugger.
Yeah.
Once we had a tree outside our house, got cut down by the local council.
Mm-hmm.
But a branch had been broken off by a truck. And so when a branch gets broken off, one of the things you want to do is paint it with a type of a tar. It's a black paint, tar paint, to prevent insects from getting in there and destroying the tree. I learned this, I was on kibbutz a long time ago. So I bought this pipe of paint.
When he says long time ago, he means previous life.
I mean, when I was
in a previous life.
I was a teenager.
This refer back to Gilgulim for this, for reincarnation, for this discussion.
So, kibbutz de Eliyahu.
Nice.
Up there. Yeah. Anyway, so I actually was trying to paint that the way in which the way the branch was and the tree, I actually had to hug the tree in order to paint the branch.
Literally a tree hugger.
And someone actually saw me and they actually said, I did not know that you were a tree hugger. Not to that, and I actually literally was hugging the tree, but
there you go.
Unfortunately, it did not survive.
If he had a phone in those days, that would be a meme.
No,
you hugging that tree.
But I'm saying this was recent. This is not long ago. This is like 10 years ago, here outside our house here in Passaic.
Oh, I thought it was at Staleyahu.
No. I learned the technique. Painted over.
You were doing this in Passaic.
Yeah, it actually is mentioned in a mission already. They used to paint the...
So how did that guy not get a picture of it?
I don't know. I do not know. Yeah. So anyway, so when it comes to the animal world, and it is sort of interesting. You look at the amount of mitzvahs that are involved in the animal world, and so many of them are about sensitivity and not causing suffering and keeping an awareness and that it becomes pretty obvious that I don't know if I got it correctly. I once asked Rabbi Uziel Malevsky, Alav Shalom.
Awesome, awesome, awesome teacher.
An incredible, incredible Torah scholar and an amazing teacher. and passed away fairly young of cancer. And so I once asked him, why do you think there's animals? It was, you know, as far as we can understand, I mean, could Hashem have created a world humans and plants? Why they're animals? So, you know, like there's I think Sefer Ikrim maybe talks about that everything is done in levels, in a gradual level. There's inanimate, and then intermediate between inanimate and fauna are maybe things like coral or something like that, I think he mentions. Or then there's intermediate between flora and fauna. There might be some other types of things like that, maybe jellyfish, I don't know what.
And anemones.
Anemones, etc. Intermediate between animal and human are things like primates. Right, that's what he actually says. Right, and then you got the human and the angel. So maybe that's to create this is the way that spirituality goes, through intermediaries, through, or rather gradual evolutionary, I mean, you know, small e type of development. But he said maybe, and I don't know if I understood him correctly, he says maybe it's that God wants us to be in the position of being like a God to these creatures as a test of how we will act.
Interesting.
Right? That you know, from the perspective of the animal, we're super. We're right. We're, you know, these beings that, right? I mean, there are animals who are faster and larger and stronger, but of course we have the brain, right? We have machine guns, we have jeeps, we have whatever, you know, it's right. Okay. So I don't know. It might be something to keep in mind. I do take tours of people to zoos, biblical zoo tours.
And you did a safari even.
Yeah,
right?
A few safaris. But the zoo tours I think are very valuable. First of all, it is, you know, that Rabbi Avadia Yosef and Rabbi Chaim David Halevi both have responsa about whether you're allowed to go, whether going to a zoo is appropriate, and they both come out that it's fine. They generally tend not to be not cruel to the animals. They tend to keep the animals in decent conditions and so on. And even if there is some element of cruelty in the fact that the animal's not free, says there's a human benefit. The human benefit is the educational component. And it's, I think, important to expose the children to animals and what we can learn from them and what the Torah says about them and the halacha and the history. And there's so much which is just amazing about animals.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
So I wanted to ask you a couple of things. One of them, I asked this to Rav Shalom Kamenetsky, Shlita, one time. We have Tamei HaMitzvahs. So, and you had mentioned with regard to Tzar Balei Chaim, causing suffering to animals, that there seem to be several mitzvahs for which the purpose is to help, you know, help us have more empathy for animals. So should we insist that, let's say I own a mink farm, and should we insist that when slaughtering the mink, that it's done with the least painful methodology possible? I don't know if shechita is, because I was once shown a demonstration that the anatomy of animals that have split hooves and chew their cud is different from other animals, and it may not be as humane. But let's say there was a methodology that was everybody agreed on was the most painless way of killing them. So should I then, in other words, should I expand this reasoning to all creatures, and should I consider myself required almost to kill them in a way that is the least painful way for them to die. And should I expand this to all aspects of my interaction with other creatures? So at the time he said to me that we don't tend to say that from Tamei HaMitzvos. We don't tend to expand them. But my thing was, then why do we have them? Why would we have this if we weren't expected to implement it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole debate in the Gemara of whether we can utilize Tamei HaMitzvos, reasons for the mitzvahs, to modify a mitzvah, is only a debate about whether you can use them to modify a verse in the Torah, to be lenient, etc. But I think there seems to be a very strong agreement that the purpose of Tamei HaMitzvot, of the purpose of those reasons, is to apply them in life. And on the contrary, I would disagree with him. There are cases where we have expanded the mitzvot based on Tamei HaMitzvos. I'll give you two examples. One's a little technical, but you're not allowed to offer an animal up on the altar if it's less than 8 days old. And what's the reason for the mitzvah? Because we don't know if it's a viable birth until after 8 days. And hence, it could be treif, could be not kosher, and hence you cannot offer it up. Now, we actually take that mitzvah and we expand it, and hence you're not allowed to eat a shechten animal under 8 days old for that same reason. The Torah only prohibits bringing it as an offering. The Torah doesn't prohibit eating it.
Right.
But the reason for the mitzvah is that, and we have used that. We do. Another example would be famous mitzvah, writing a Torah scroll. So we know that the Rosh and the Shulchan Aruch and other Rishonim say that since the whole reason given in the Torah for writing a Torah scroll is so you can learn from it and teach from it, since nowadays no one learns from the Torah scroll, you don't whip out a Torah and start learning from it, we learn from books, right? We learn from, so the mitzvah nowadays is to buy, acquire, and to write books from which we do learn. So you've taken the Tamei HaMitzvah, and you've said, I mean, it goes even further than that, but at least the minimalist view is that if you've only written the Torah scroll, you have not yet fulfilled the mitzvah because the Tamei HaMitzvah is not there. So there's other examples of this where it actually can be have an application in halacha. And we know that, for example, in the Pisrei Tshuva in Yoredeya, talks about that technically the prohibition of causing pain to animals only applies to the large domesticated animals like cows, sheep, goats, etc., which the Torah speaks about. Insects, fish, reptiles are not covered by it. However, the commentaries say, since Verachamav al kol ma'asav, God's mercy is upon all his creatures, we should extend that to them as well and not be cruel even to those animals that are technically not covered by this. So if we see that there's a Tamei HaMitzvah behind how we slaughter animals, which is to try to kill them with the least pain possible, I don't see why that should not be extended. It appears to me that that's
happening. You don't hear about kashrus organizations
or
rabbonim,
right,
that maybe expand into this territory.
Correct. I don't know how many Jews own mink farms or Canadian.
No, but a lot of us use leather, and also a lot of us eat meat from or eggs or chickens or whatever, and we're not checking into the quality of the treatment of the animals in those places. And it doesn't seem like I remember we're in conversation when PETA came out with that video of Shchita at the Rubashkin.
Yes.
They had an undercover guy,
right,
who was videoing. And, so I remember both of us sort of talking about how, even though you can give a lot of justification for the Shchita, and you could say that these are just nerve reactions that you're seeing afterwards, right? But the treatment of the animal up to the Shchita, that's another story. You know, like if they're kept in decrepit pens or things like that, or in ways that it didn't have to be. You know, like let's say we say it. I'm not accusing anybody.
Yeah, there is some level of supervision. I do know that some kosher organizations do take that into account. I believe the OU does.
They do.
I believe so. I believe there
that
is.
They if they don't think the animals are, if they think the animals are being mistreated, you think there might be an example where they would refuse to give a hechsher to the player?
I would have to do research on that. But I did hear that somewhere. I don't know, but I think to some degree we may, yeah, maybe there should be some. You know, I don't know. It's hard to know. Hard to know. There, you have to balance financial burden. Kosher meat, as it happens, is way more expensive than non-kosher meat.
Yeah.
Right. To impose further restrictions and so on the production of kosher meat is going to make it even, it might make it prohibitively expensive for Jews.
Do you know how much does it cost? Like we have here in Chicago, we have several places where you can get a roasted chicken, an already roasted chicken. I would say it's like a medium size roasted chicken. You can get it regularly for like $11.99.
Okay.
So work your way backwards. Somebody roasted that chicken. Then as you're working your way, the store that's selling it, they're selling retail. They had to get it from somewhere else. And then it goes back to the farmer. He has to feed it. He has to do everything. Somehow this whole thing just cost $11.99.
That sounds very good.
I think know. It's ridiculous. Now, yeah. And if we imagine if you had only a few chickens per a few feet, and you were feeding it, you weren't doing like injecting them with hormones or whatever else they're doing. Let's say you were trying to keep it as natural and as healthy as possible.
Twice the cost.
Yeah, probably be like $30 a chicken or something that. Yeah.
So look, poskim, yes. I know that halachic decisors have to take into account, you're supposed to take into account financial hardship, sociological hardship. I mean, there's a range of factors, but it's worth thinking about. I just think that we have raised, this, worth thinking about. Should we end with one of my favorite is
please.
A baby seal walks into a bar. Bartender says, "What do you have?" He says, "Anything but Canadian club."
I like it.
Yeah. Anyway, that's apropos of our discussion.
Yes. Yes.
And one of my favorite clips is from Portlandia. I believe you showed it to me. About the chicken with this couple.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, is that awesome?
Walks into a restaurant and they ask about the chicken. And the waitress comes back and she brings a portfolio with the chicken's name and where it was brought up. And they said, "Did he have friends where he lived?" Well, she says, "I can't speak to the social atmosphere there. It would be terrible to me if the farm that he is on is all organically grown local producers, but it's not owned by some guy living on a yacht somewhere offshore. Oh, no, it's all locally." And eventually they end up going to the farm. They said, "Could you hold the table?" And they go to the farm and they end up, it's a cult, and they end up joining the cult on this farm. It's like this, it's really one of the best clips I've ever seen in my life. I got to thank
And as long as we're throwing in those comedic things, I think it's Nate Bargatze who has the routine about how he would specifically not eat organic chickens or chickens that have been raised in that kind of environment. He said, because those chickens that have been raised in those other environments, they had a good life. They dreamed of a future. They were taken care of. And then suddenly you pluck them out of that and you kill them. These other chickens have been suffering since they came out of the egg. To them, you're slaughtering them is a gift, a relief. I would much rather eat a chicken that never had a hope.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting perspective. Okay. Who is this Rabbi Bargetze? Who is this?
He's got a congregation. It's a YouTube congregation.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mostly. Very nice.
Yeah.
All right. As always, folks, I'm happy that that the few of you who watch actually do. And thank you very much. Please
like it
and share and get this around. And God willing, we will see you next time.
Be well.